Hey, welcome to Undaunted. My name is David Gunger. This is a podcast about radical peacemakers. Today, our guest is Lana Abu-Hijli. Lana is a peacemaker and an activist, as well as an entrepreneur. Lana was kind enough to join me from Palestine via Zoom. I really enjoyed being able to speak to Lana. This is our conversation.
David, I'm Lana Abu-Hijli. I am married also to Nasser Abdel Hadi. Have three daughters. I'm Palestinian. I live in Jerusalem on lockdown in Jericho, where we have a second home, thank God. Well, I grew up in a city called Nablus. It is about 45 kilometers, that's what, about 30 miles or so north of Jerusalem. It was quite a childhood, actually. I would say my teenage years were in the 70s. So basically grew up under occupation. Quite interesting because that's all what I knew at the time. Went to school, finished high school there. Of course, it was for me quite interesting because those were the times when people were still going out to demonstrations. We were leaving school, going out to basically object occupation and so on. So that was my childhood. But I think what it gave me is the sense of, I want to be free. I didn't know what it meant fully, but there was something wrong. You know, you walk out of your school, there were always army jeeps outside, and kids would be throwing stones, and then I would be scolded by my mom because I didn't come back home directly. She was always worried about us, me and my three younger brothers. But I had a wonderful childhood with my parents. My dad was a doctor, a surgeon. My mom was a teacher. And she stopped teaching in 1967 when the occupation started of the West Bank and Gaza and the rest of historic Palestine, because the Israelis at the time wanted to change the curriculum. So she's in protest. Many teachers stopped teaching. So I grew up in a family that appreciated education a lot and felt that we should always be well-educated, know what we want, have the tools in life to advance, regardless of where we happen to be born and grow up. So I enjoyed that. They took care of my education. To the point I went to school in the U.S., went to college in the U.S., and I'm the eldest and no sisters in an Arab culture, quite conservative. So the decision of my parents to send me at 16, 17-year-old to the U.S. to study, and I'll tell you where now I went to school, was quite surprising to the society we live in. You don't send your daughter, you know, Arab, Muslim, and so on, to the U.S. to study. I went to school in Iowa, University of Iowa. So I am a Hawkeye, basically. And I arrived there 1981, during the winter. So all what I could see was snow. And more snow, driving from Chicago to Iowa City, and lots of cornfields. And I kept on calling my parents, say, where is America? Where is America we saw on TV? For me, America at that time, I mean, whoever is going to be listening to this and remember those times, is Hawaii 5-0, is Steve McGarrett. I don't see him here. But I loved it. I loved studying at University of Iowa. I loved the people there. I loved the sense of freedom I had. I loved the fact that I could go out of school and not have to carry three forms of ID. I loved the fact I could stay late and know that I'm going to get home safely. So I stayed till 1986, finished my engineering degree, Next day, I was on a plane, come back because I wanted to serve my people. I wanted to help build the foundations of my country, the engineer who's coming back. Well, it was quite a different experience coming back as a woman engineer, 22-year-old, thinks she knows the world and has to now, in a culture that was not used to so many female engineers, go on site, on construction sites, and where? In Gaza. So I landed my first job with the UN, and it was to go and build a sewage system in Jabalia refugee camp. This is one of the largest Palestinian refugee camps, mostly refugees who were expelled from the homeland in 1948. And even for a Palestinian who lived in was born and raised in Palestine, in a city like Nablus, it was a big shock for me. But it grounded me, and thank God for that, because I think that's where I really learned what life is about, what freedom is about, what the love of the homeland is about, and the love for who you are, for your culture, for every small thing that makes you the human being you are. So it's a nice combination. Grow up in the West Bank, under occupation, got a great taste in the US, got a wonderful education, came back and worked in a place where it reminded me who I am and how we should be living as Palestinians, not the way I saw it in the refugee camps. So this is a bit on my background.
I know that your story did not end as just an engineer, but a lot of people would be very interested to hear how you used your mind as a businesswoman to help spark the imagination for what freedom could look like. So could you tell us a little bit about the different ways in which you used your imagination as an entrepreneur and as a businesswoman?
Well, I worked with the UN for about 17 years with UNDP and started as an engineer. Then Oslo started with it, the peace process in the mid-90s. Then I felt building a country, building your homeland is not about the concrete and the mortar and the bricks and all only. It's about the human beings, and it's about the institutions, and it's about trying to create a future for the young people who are not as fortunate as I was. Family who believed in education, had the means and resources to get an excellent education and the freedom to make a choice to come back even, because many other Palestinians don't have that choice. So when Oslo started, I decided to work on building the Palestinian institutions from the ground. So I worked through the UN platform on building the new ministries, creating the good governance system, working with municipalities, working on promoting democratic processes. I was lucky to be one of the teams that worked on the first elections in Palestine, the presidential and then the legislative and then the municipal. Actually, I work with President Jimmy Carter and his monitoring team in 2005 and 2006. And then, something happened in my life around 2002. I'll share it with you. You know, when I first came back, the first uprising in the 80s happened, and it reminded us all that life is not easy. This is an occupation, a military occupation. In the year 2000, the second uprising started. And I was in the midst of working with the UN, responding to the humanitarian needs with the second uprising, although that we had a Palestinian Authority. At the time, still, there were Israeli incursions Israeli army incursions into the Palestinian cities and so on, while I'm busy with all of that, working on, let's say, fostering the peace process, helping promote peace, not in Palestine and elsewhere, because I was with the UN, suddenly something happens. In 2002, 11th of October, while my parents were sitting at home in our city in Nablus, it was a curfew, meaning the Israeli army would impose a curfew, nobody can move and so on. And they were sitting at home at the porch. My mom was embroidering and my dad, they couldn't go anywhere, was reading. And suddenly an Israeli army jeep passed by our home. And I'll have to admit, we live in an upscale neighborhood, in a villa and so on. So you think sometimes you're protected because of that. I don't know, for whatever reason, the army jeep fired a spray of bullets at our home. And my mother was killed on the spot. And my father was injured. And my brother, who was sitting inside, the house also was injured because they sprayed them with, I don't know, about 14, 15 bullets from automatic gun, an M16. So I almost lost my entire family in a split second. My dad made it, but I don't know, you say made it, but he saw the love of his life die in front of his eyes, and as a surgeon and a doctor, couldn't do anything. And my brother survived, thank God. But my beautiful mom, my friend, I just told you that I'm an only daughter. I don't have sisters. She was my friend, my sister, my mom, the one who supported me throughout. I never cared about the conservative environment we lived in. Gave me my freedom, taught me to be who I am now. I'm wearing her necklace now. It always reminds me of that. That was, I think, the biggest pain any human being can feel, because you suddenly feel unprotected, vulnerable. You read about these things, you know, in the newspaper. You work with the UN. You help families who face this, but it doesn't happen to you. But it reminded me that as Palestinians, there is no discrimination when it comes to harm. We could all be harmed in a second. Well, to be honest, it took me a while to get out of bed, to want to live again. The anger, the hate, which I was not raised to hate, I was raised with a lot of love, was filling me up. And all what I could think about was revenge, you know, because I could do nothing else. And my three brothers, who also went to school in Iowa, one of them is married to an Iowan and lives there and has two sons. We all gathered from all around the world. And we were like, how are we going to deal with this? You know, as I said, it was all inside us, hate and revenge feelings. And it made me understand how people could go mad after they go through such an experience and even lose their sense of humanity. So my father was the one who actually, I would say, rescued all of us. He gathered us in his hospital and said, "I can feel you're getting ideas that don't represent you or me or your mom." Because all of what we could think about is how many Zionist Israelis are we going to kill? How many lives is our mom's life worth? But our dad said, "Listen, we raised you differently. We raised you in a way, we gave you the tools, so whenever you face an atrocity like this, you can deal with them as human beings. You can use the tools you gain throughout your life to keep your humanity, to change the world, to make sure this doesn't happen to anybody else. And that's how you revenge your mom. Not with more blood, not with more killing. This is not going to end it." And he made us promise. So the four of us gave him a promise And a week after, I even wrote a letter to a family, an Israeli family, who lost their husband and through a suicide attack, because I could feel their pain. I could feel that there is no difference in the color of our blood. Only if together we can stop the reasons for all of this hatred and killing, if together we can just stop this occupation, because it's not only an occupation of land, it's an occupation of the heart, of the mind, of the soul, and it can change people. It can change people on both sides and take humanity out of them. Because I couldn't even think, David, of how those soldiers who just fired from a machine gun, sitting in the safety of an army jeep, at a house where a woman and her husband were sitting peacefully, sipping their tea, embroidering, and go home and be okay. Go home to their moms, to their girlfriends, their wives, and be okay. So I wrote to those soldiers and I said, I hope one day you will recognize that you took a beautiful life, a life of a woman who used to carry roses and stand in front of tanks, of army tanks, because she felt this is how you stop this occupation, this hatred. In any case, this is the time where I felt I needed to do something different with my life. I wanted to, I'll tell you, not build things, not. I wanted to help create hope. What saved me was hope that one day, justice will prevail. Justice is something so precious, it can drive humanity forward when we all feel equal. Now in this COVID-19 crisis, I just feel, imagine if the world was all equal, justice prevailed, because justice is not about occupying your land. When you don't have access to health or education or services, that's injustice. But, well, I went back, quit my job with the UN and joined a wonderful NGO, an American NGO called Global Communities, used to be known as CHF International, because I wanted to go back to the grassroots. I wanted to work in villages, in communities, in refugee camps, not to be a director of this and a director of that, not to just go to and speak in conferences and so on. I wanted to go back to where it all happens, where I'm reminded why I'm doing this, where I see the happy eyes of the children when we build a beautiful school for them to learn in, where I give a workshop about the meaning of democracy, freedom, good governance to young Palestinians. And I started a movement called Youth Local Councils. And this movement of young Palestinians from age 15 to 24 is about serving their communities, using their own agency, believing in their capacity and skills, going back to this volunteerism, to volunteer, to just be good people. And I thought if that is my contribution, those are going to be the leaders of the future. And if I can help create good leaders from now, good leaders from now, my mom would be happy with me. So I created this organization called SHIAM. SHIAM in Arabic means good values. SHIAM, Youth Make the Future. That was 2008. Till now, I'm so happy because I came to know thousands of Palestinian youth, know how amazing they are with the little resources they have, the unprivileged life they had. Unlucky, they were born Palestinian, I thought. No, very lucky, because through atrocities, through hardship, I met amazing young women and men who now are all over the country doing amazing things. And some of them even are municipal councillors, they run for elections, doctors, lawyers, journalists, artists. I hope I managed to touch their life in a different way. Now, how I came to become a business leader. While I was working with these youth, I thought, okay, good to teach youth about becoming good citizens, Palestinian youth, about their agency, about being good human beings, and so on. At the end of the day, we live in real economic hardship because of the occupation. They want jobs. They want to employ their innovations. So I thought maybe the best thing to do now is, from all this experience I had with the UN and with civil society and with working with youth, I'll find my way into the private sector and start creating bridges between civil society and the private sector, the Palestinian private sector. And it worked. They found that I can bring a lot to the table. And I started joining certain boards, and now I'm probably the only woman in Palestine who chairs the largest investment company in Palestine, in real estate, in tourism, in renewable energy, and so on. I'm the chairwoman, which, so I'm, thank God, breaking the glass ceiling for many Palestinian women now. And I hope the young people I work with, the young females I work with, see that it can be done. I don't have millions. I don't have lots of money. I got into these circles because of what I bring to the table in terms of vision, in terms of sense of good governance. And this is what I want Palestine to be about. Strong partnerships, visionary people, with an eye to the globe. We can teach the globe a lot and learn a lot from the world. So now, even my husband, who is a businessman, who never thought I will be in this sphere, he's in hotels and he's a chef and he has restaurants and so on. And he always say, how come now you talk about investments and acquisitions and mergers? I never thought you cared about these things. But I do now. And I just started a few months ago a new initiative called Women Lead. So this is a new exciting thing I keep on getting myself in, because I want more women to be sitting on boards. I sit on the board of the largest bank, on the largest investment company, and I want more than Lena on them. So through this Women Lead initiative, I am hoping that many middle management, very talented young Palestinian women now find it possible to climb up the ladder and prove that they are amazing business leaders. We'll see. Talk to me in 2-3 years.
One of the first things that jumped out to me, I love that you say, and you said it so confidently, you said, I started a movement. Sometimes people, when they hear things about stories of incredible people, they have this pause because they think, I don't even know where to start. And you said, I started a movement. How did you do that? What was the imagination to where you thought you could start a movement? Or what would you say to people that when they hear that, they go, how does a movement start? How does it begin?
Movement starts with an idea and a belief and a vision and a dream and hope. All of that in your mind, and you don't sleep at night, and you start thinking, no, it's not going to happen. It's so hard. And when am I going to find the time? But when you know that you've been blessed, even with all what happened to me, I was blessed with the love you just mentioned. I was blessed with the support I had. I had to give back. And all what it took is to find, I started in only four communities because I was working in those four communities, small villages in the West Bank of Palestine. And I found those amazing 16-year-olds. And these kids were telling me, why are you coming to help our municipality? The municipality is corrupt and they don't help the people who they should help. And I said, so what are you doing about it? And they said, we go out at night and we throw stones at the lights, at the street, and we break them. And I said, that's going to fix the municipality. That was seriously, the debate that started. That's going to fix the municipality. And they said, yes, we're hurting them. And I said, how about if you become the mayor? And they said, we become the mayors? We'll never become the mayors. Who's going to elect us? We don't know how to become the mayors. I said, okay, I'm going to teach you how you're going to one day run for elections and be elected as the mayors. Would you work with me? And they said, okay. You have to interview this guy, Ahmed Diri. I'll never forget him. He's married now, he has children, and he's an amazing trainer, actually. So I said, okay, we're going to form now a shadow council to the municipal council of young people who are aged 15, like you, up to 22 when you finish college. But you have to convince your friends to elect you to the youth council. And it started there. And from four communities, had about what, in each town, probably we had 200-300 kids participating, to now more than 60 councils. And I'm an Aspen, I don't know if you know the Aspen Institute in the US, I'm an Aspen fellow. And they helped me grow the venture. And we were selected in 2017 as the winners of the McNulty Prize for this initiative globally for value-based leadership. Palestine and Palestinian youth were selected as the winners of the McNulty Prize. I was by a panel of judges, not easy, headed by Madeleine Albright. Dr. Albright loved it. And, you know, a wonderful panel of judges. So these are the stories I wanted out of Palestine. I wanted people in America to see what Palestinian children can do when given the opportunity, when given a platform, when given a voice. And now I think at least 40, 50,000 young Palestinians have been through. Still, during the COVID-19, you should have seen them, how they all mobilized, were distributing hygiene kits to vulnerable families, food, awareness on how to quarantine and how to... I'm very proud, very proud mama of all these kids. They're not kids now, of course. When you start something in 2008, now you meet them in conferences and you meet them on jobs and you are walking on the street and they say, Miss Lana, that's us. You remember us. That venture that we were part of, we ran for elections and we were elected or we did this and did that. Very proud of them. And we took this initiative through a global communities to Honduras and to Ukraine. So Palestinian kids were exporting good governance, democratic ideas about youth and good values. So this is how you start a movement with a dream, with one child inciting you to do something positively and with a lot of work and dedication, and with good people who believe in you and support you, like the McNulty Foundation and many other people from the private sector here who've been helping me through this venture. And now it's an organization and it's growing on its own, and I'm only a chairwoman and I don't have to do much. The youth themselves do it, and they organize hackathons, and they do coding, and they do stuff like that. Stuff I don't understand, so they're way ahead of me. In any case, but you know what also helped me? Dance and music. I have always been obsessed with dance, Palestinian dance. And when I came back from college, we don't have dance schools here. We never had dance schools here. It's another thing I wanted to do. So from the mid 80s, I joined a small dance group here. And in March, on 9th of March, we celebrated our 40th anniversary. 40 years, a dance group who are now, we are about 300 dancers. I'm the chairwoman of the board. I don't dance anymore, my 50s, so. But when we celebrated, I went on stage and I danced. So I don't care about age. So it was beautiful because I danced on the same stage with my daughter. And I'll tell you what dance did to me. The only way I was able to deal with my mom's loss and trauma is to choreograph a beautiful piece, I think, for me. I mean, I didn't perform it, for her. And through the process of choreographing, I felt that I connected with her, and I connected with what she represented, the beauty of art and dance. And now our dance group has a dance school, and we teach kids around Palestine to dance. We have a program to go to very vulnerable, franchised communities. And we create dance groups there of young boys and girls. When people look at us as if we are, you know, only those miserable Palestinians who only see death, and we're not about that. You should come and watch one of our performances. You should see our dancers do contemporary dance with a Palestinian spirit. Of course, I can never do what they do now, because with the dance school, they are able and they can fly and they can go on the ground and they can split and they can do stuff I never can do. My daughter can do it, but they can express beautiful feelings, and they tour around the world and they show the world another face. Unfortunately, the media doesn't show of Palestinians. The real beauty of Palestinian art, of Palestinian identity, which forms who we are. It's our music, it's our dance, it's our embroidery, it's our poetry, it's our beautiful kids' eyes, it's our sad times, it's our happy times, like everybody else. And this is what I hope the world could see us. So I dance too, yeah.
For those who hear this story and they're so inspired by you and they think, I want to help, as far as your Western friends, how can we support you and how can we help you, and in which ways can we be good neighbors and good friends to you?
Learn about the Palestinian cause. If you believe in justice, justice has to prevail everywhere. The solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is simple. End the occupation and the military control of people to another people. Can you imagine that we are not free to travel? We are not free to access our resources. We are not free to just dream that our children will be safe. They will not go out and be stopped at a military checkpoint, and for whatever reason, something happens, they could be hurt and harmed. That they will go out of the house and I'll be comfortable that they will come back. Learn about who we are. Don't just watch the short clip that when I am in Washington or in DC at our office or work and so on, I always call my husband and say, my God, I know now why nobody knows anything. You should see how they reported this story. We don't want to be seen as the victims. This is not it. We want to be seen as regular human beings who deserve to have a free life. And how can you help? Unfortunately, now we live in difficult times. And when people come and visit from the US, even Congress people, senators, it only takes 24 hours on the ground to make people know that they've been blinded most of their lives. That what is happening here and the way the Israelis are representing this issue is not accurate at all. And the way they are acting now on how to solve it, in a few weeks they're going to annex most of the West Bank, meaning the chance for having a Palestinian state that's an independent, sovereign, free, able to be part of this globe will be not just so slim, will disappear. This is not going to be sustainable, not only for us, but also for the Israelis. And I always tell my Jewish friends in America, I think you should be helping Palestinians, not because of the interest of Palestinians, because this is in the interest of Israelis. This is in the interest of long-term, lasting, sustainable peace. That's how they can live in this region, in this, with us, without fear, as long as they're denying the rights of millions and millions of Palestinians inside Palestine and outside to return to their homeland, they'll always be concerned about the future. Let's end it now. And I think this is the message, our friends in America need to push it, not just on the US administration, but also on our Israeli neighbors. Listen, people think that it is about the Muslims, the Jews, the Christians, and so on. This has nothing to do with your faith. I also have a mixed family. My ex-husband was Christian. My daughter is Christian. My two other daughters are Muslims. They're both, the three of them are raised in the house respecting the two faiths. In this house, we are Christians and Muslims. And I always tell my husband, my second husband, you know, don't bother me much. I could have my eye and next on a Jew. So. So this house could be complete. So imagine if we can all live like this, without worrying what is your faith or my faith or his faith. That's for me. That's for you. And I did it with my three daughters. We celebrate Christmas. We celebrate Eid al-Fitr. We celebrate Ramadan. We celebrate all of that because this is about each of our personal faith. So what is stopping us from recognizing the most important message here is we are all human beings. We are all equal. I don't care who's promised what, when. This is about now and the future. Let us now recognize that regardless of your faith, your ethnicity, your color, your religion, your whatever, we all deserve justice. The present situation is about total injustice for the Palestinians. I'm one of the lucky ones. I could travel to Tel Aviv and I could travel to Gaza. The disparity between the two is beyond imagination. I go to Gaza and I see, because I work with a humanitarian organization, when I talk about food insecure and hunger is over 80% of the population, what do you want these people? They've been under this siege for almost 13, 14 years now. Do you want them to be loving? Do you want them? And still, when you go there, you see the smiles of these amazing children. War after war, destruction after destruction. Is this how we create a new generation of people who want to live as neighbors? When I come back from Gaza, I spend usually 2-3 days. My daughters always say, Mom should be under quarantine, because whatever we say now, she's going to say, you got to go to Gaza and see how people live there. We're not allowed to buy anything or eat anything or go to a restaurant, because she'll always say, I'll take you to Gaza and you see how people live there. It's true. I want to take you to Gaza and show you how people live there. 2 million Palestinians, 80% food insecure. Is this even possible? Hungry people, more than 80% the unemployment. So when you know all of these stories, then you have no excuse. I always say that. Once you know, you have no excuse. You have to tell also the story. You have to tell it to your congressperson. You have to tell it to your senator. You have to tell it to your neighbor. That whatever we hear about this issue of the Palestinians, there is much more to it. There are beautiful people that we should also learn about, care about, and help. Injustice somewhere is injustice everywhere, right? Or something like that, whatever Martin Luther King said.
Thank you for joining me. And this was absolutely wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And thanks to Taylor's group. I've always loved what they're doing. They're telling the story. They're helping more people know so they don't have an excuse.
Undaunted is a podcast about radical peacemakers. It's produced by myself, David Gunger, as well as members from our Telos team. Original music composition by Brennan Smiley, as well as songs from The Brilliance. Thank you for joining us today. Come back next week for a brand new podcast. My name is David Gunger. I hope that you'll stay curious. Give me